hear the thoughts now, what the heck has happened to Jeff's voice? He sounds terrible. Well, the only thing wrong with Jeff's voice is that you're not hearing it. Jeff, unfortunately, has had an opportunity to, he's had to do something else at the moment. So this is Russ Pavlicek, and I'm sitting in on the host chair tonight. But we do have at least about half of the staff tonight. So we still have a bunch of interesting things going on. In particular, segment two, we'll be talking with Eric Raymond, and once again, some of the more interesting goings on in the SCO world. And I know that a lot of people are really tired of what's going on with SCO, but I think we might actually be starting to approach an end game of sorts. So we'll be discussing that sort of stuff.
And we can be very thankful that we now know, thanks to Rob Enderle, that SCO should win.
Yes. Let's not get ahead of ourselves, Arnie. That's going to be one of the interesting stories in segment one. And speaking of segment one, let's introduce our panel for tonight. Let's start first with Kevin inside the greater Chicagoland area. How are you doing, Kevin?
Oh, I'm doing pretty good. Weather's still getting better here. I don't know why we seem to always keep talking about the weather in Chicago. It's probably the least attractive part of the city, but...
Well, maybe that's why it gets discussed. So
I think the word discussed is awfully well chosen there.
So, and of course, on the far left coast, we have Arnie. How you doing, Arnie?
Oh, doing fine here. We've had 2 days of 90-plus degree weather here in the Inland Empire of California, and this is right after the snow-capped mountains finally got a good dose of snow stuff, skiing stuff, and Baldy Village was reveling in the fact that they're having a great snow season, and all of a sudden the temperature hits nearly the century mark. So, go figure.
Well, that must be interesting trying to ski as the snow is melting underneath you.
You never know. Up there, of course, up at the mountaintop, it's much cooler.
Much cooler. Okay. Well, that's good to hear. And we have. Unfortunately, Doc is not with us tonight, and as I said, Jeff is in transit, so he may be joining us later. But we do have our guest for segment two, who's also our frequent guest for news and commentary, Eric Raymond. How are you doing, Eric?
Heidi, heidi ho.
How's are you in Pennsylvania tonight?
I am.
And I gather you're not having snow.
We had some snow earlier. It came down. It stopped. It's sticking on the roads and making things look like a Christmas card.
Oh, good golly. Aren't we done with this yet? So, I'm Russ, and I'm out here in Maryland, and things are cool but dry. But now on to the more interesting things. How about we start tonight with Kevin? Kevin, do you have first off, you have an announcement to make about the website, correct?
Yeah. Well, it's not exactly a timely announcement, but in case people haven't noticed, we have been playing with a new forum section using the PHP BB package. So if anybody wants to jump in and discuss any of the stories we have on the show or anything else related to Linux or even just general stuff, feel free to jump in and check it out and post some comments, and hopefully I know we have a very active IRC during the show, so hopefully we can carry on some of that over into the forum during the rest of the week.
Yes, indeed. That is something to note too, and we all know that our IRC folks are some of the most dedicated folks around, so you folks out there take a break typing to your pals and go over and take a look at the forum and see what's going on there. That should be pretty interesting. And now, Kevin, you had other more newsy things to talk about, correct?
Yeah, it's not actually Linux related, but sort of in the techno-political area that we've been covering lately. There's been an interesting feud going on between Viacom and Dish Network, the satellite TV provider. Apparently, there was a some dispute on renewing the contract for Viacom channels, which includes all the MTV channels and Comedy Central and all of the Nickelodeon channels. And so they decided that Viacom would run scrolling messages on all of their channels saying that Dish TV was about to lose these channels, so if you wanted to call Dish's 800 support number and voice your complaint, then Dish countered by putting a black bar over the scrolling messages whenever they popped up.
Oh my gosh.
And I guess they actually have turned off their stations, but I have not actually been able to confirm that. I actually haven't seen any up-to-date news on where this is standing.
Wow. You know, it's interesting that you mentioned this, because I hadn't, with everything going on, me personally, I hadn't known about the dispute, although I did see the running ads at the bottom of these stations saying that Dish Network was going to take them off. And I was wondering, why is this on here? Because I have cable, so you know, why do I care about Dish Network? But apparently, as you said, it's coming from the source. But that's pretty wild.
Yeah, what's amazing about this is Dish Network's doing is okay. We cannot come to an agreement with CBS, Viacom. Therefore, we're going to punish our customers. You know.
Well, to take their point of view, if they came to an agreement, that would translate directly into a price increase for the customers.
Yeah, that's true.
Which is the whole point. Well, I guess the basis of the disagreement, although this varies depending on which opinions read, is that Viacom wanted to require them to take a new Nickelodeon channel, which is basically just repeats of stuff that's on their other channels, and take a substantial price increase along with it.
Okay.
Which is interesting. A lot of people, on the one hand, are saying that the cable and satellite providers should offer customers the ability to pick and choose individual channels, yet a lot of people are jumping on Dish Networks for standing up when their providers are trying to pull the bundling that they are pulling on their customers.
That's pretty wild. You know, what goes around comes around, it seems. It's
it'll be interesting to see how this plays out.
Yeah. You know, you got some behemoths wrestling here.
And I wonder if anyone in Washington still thinks it's a good idea for two or three companies to own all of the media outlets in this country.
Yeah, that's another interesting topic, I'll tell you.
That's an issue I've thought about, and I've decided that I completely refuse to worry about it, because the media that people are worrying about getting concentrated are less and less important every day.
Yeah.
Worrying about concentration in old media is fighting yesterday's battle.
Yeah, I think the bigger issue in a lot of sense is making sure that today's media can stay free enough to operate.
That's not exactly an encouraging thought, though, because of the attempts by big media to control the new media stuff.
Yeah. But I think Eric, you're right. That's where the focus has to be, really, for the important stuff. The old joke is that, you know, we've got cable and so we've got 300 channels and there's still nothing on, and that seems to be, you know, the sickness, so to speak, of old media, is that it's more and more it's losing. Anything close to value, you know, and I spend most of my time in front of a tube, but it has nothing to do with television. It has to do with what's going on over the internet, and that seems to be much higher value these days.
I don't watch much TV at all.
Yeah. So let's okay, Kevin, do you have anything else that you want to talk about?
Well, that's the big point for this week.
Okay. Alrighty, well, how about we turn over to Arnie on the West Coast? You had some links, didn't you?
Yes, I had a few.
Okay.
In particular, there's one on the website. Let me get them in the right order here. Let's see. Right, skip that one, skip that one. Okay. Using Oracle, say yes to Linux, no to REST. Apparently, and this is happening in the database field, there's another article that dovetails nicely with it in study open source databases going mainstream. Apparently, the database could be the Linux next killer app. We've always done web services very well and email and stuff, but database engines seems to be gathering a lot of steam here. In the first article about Oracle, apparently Oracle and Linux fit together so well that this has become quite a boon for Oracle. And this is from CXO Today, which is I believe an Indian Southeast Asian Indian publication, and they explain how the bank let's see which bank is it Central Bank of India is using Linux in Oracle in their databases. And this also we've talked about recently, that banks and financial institutions seem to be going Linux, and this could be part of what's driving this movement.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of stuff. In fact, with some of the things I've been doing recently, you can't help but fall over the stuff that's going on with Oracle. And it's absolutely amazing. I mean, for years, Oracle was, or at least tried to be, more or less architecture agnostic. They tried to position themselves as the one great solution that you know, seemed to run anywhere. These days, however, if you take a look at the information coming out of Oracle, they're talking about Linux, and I mean they're talking about Linux. And like you alluded to, Arnie, a lot of it for them is a simplification and lower cost, because you know, they are the more time they can spend with, you know, basically one port or perhaps two ports of software, the easier it is for them. But when they're pitching a solution, an Oracle engine, which is basically what they like to put out there, or a cluster of engines, Linux fits very naturally, because it keeps their costs down on you know, on their proposals and everything else. I mean, it's the type of the thing that they like.
Yeah, and well, let's see. There's no love lost between Oracle and Microsoft. So. But I don't really for a minute think that that's what's driving this thing. I really think that what's driving it is true utility and the fit of the database engine with the Linux architecture.
Right, and I think for them particularly too, cost is another big issue, because when they had to bid it on some of the larger Unix vendors, the old style Unix stuff, that would be a substantial extra cost that you know, the customer would have to swallow. The costs that they can at least put on paper for a Linux based solution actually drop down without affecting their profit margin at all.
So. The second article talks about the open source databases, and basically it's a straightforward advocacy piece, but it does mention MySQL, MaxDB, Postgres, SQL, and also SleepyCat's Berkeley database. Berkeley database has always been one of my favorite little tools, and it's a very, very minimalistic database, and certainly not SQL based or anything like that, but for doing simple little things and even doing complicated things, it can be very efficient.
Yeah, if I remember correctly, the Berkeley database is used often as an embedded sort of thing inside another solution.
Yes.
Where they just want some internal database function, but they don't need something big and huge and
okay. Well, even for larger things, it can be very efficient, because it's linked in. It's not a an engine.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, SleepyCat actually used to be pretty visible at a lot of the early Linux worlds and whatnot, and it just sort of occurs to me that I don't think I've seen them so much in the last couple of years. But I know they're out there.
Yeah, I mean, the Berkeley database is the database behind basically every Linux installation that does all the simple databasing for the kernel and for, you know, various services. It's kind of, it's just there.
Yep. Well, that's it. I mean, it's been there for a long time, and it works well.
I use it occasionally for various things. It's interesting. Interesting, very, very minimalistic thing where you can just take and apply the same model to a variety of different applications. It's very flexible. But, of course, I just think administrating a SQL is to be a little bit cumbersome sometimes. And, you know, need it for everything.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, it depends on what you're doing. I mean, for the applications that MySQL is designed for, you know, doing, like, simple read-only acts for web pages, it's really hard to beat.
Right.
Yes, yes. And MySQL certainly is, and in Postgres also, are both very targeted clearly at that type of application. I've not seen MaxDB, but apparently it's gaining some ground, too.
I've actually played with it. I played with SAPDB before it, SAPDB, which is what it came out of.
Oh, okay, I know that one.
Which came out of, jeepers. It's actually inheritor of one of the very old lines of databases, the name of which, Adabas.
Oh, yes, I know that one, too.
Yeah, and it had, that's going to be one of those interesting ones to watch over time, because in its current form, or at least as of a few months ago, you really saw the old crufty database nature of the beast there. Like when something went wrong, you get, you know, an error number and a code that really didn't make a hell of a lot of sense. Kind of reminiscent of something circa 1980 or something like this. It'll be interesting to see, since it is an enterprise level engine, enterprise capable engine, how the MySQL people who've done, you know, a phenomenal job of putting together something that's easy to use as far as databases go. It'll be interesting to see how that beast develops and whether it actually feels like it belongs in this millennium.
Do you think that maybe the database stuff is what's partially driving some of the multiple, you know, the big installation, big Linux installations where we're talking about, you know, multiple machines dealing applications?
I think it's been a big push, particularly Oracle, because Oracle does Linux, and if you're going to follow. So I think that's a major piece of it. Obviously, IBM on the other side with DB2 and WebSphere and all those things has their own push going into Linux, not because it's Linux, but because that's where the apps are in a particular sense.
And meanwhile, on the Microsoft side, they have Microsoft SQL.
Yes, they do.
Something I'm somewhat familiar with a little bit, and you know, it's SQL of sorts.
Yeah. Well, I guess that, I'm trying to remember. I think that was birthed out of Sybase or something once upon a time, I thought.
It could be. Although it came by way of Access, which is interesting.
I'm trying to. Well, I won't go there. I don't remember the history offhand, but there is.
I mean, was there SQL was originally integrated into Microsoft Access.
Yeah. So, you got anything else for us, Arnie?
Sure. Yeah. Rob Limo has a Robin Miller. Let's make sure I get this right because he's in the IRC room. One of the editors at Slashdot and at NewsForge. Fame is got a really good is interviewed about his about Novalug, which is the Northern Virginia Linux Users Group, attendance for the last 5 years at the Federal Office Systems Exposition. And this is kind of an interesting article, as far as federal trade shows, that's probably one of the ones you want to be at. And Novalug has been there for 5 years now, and it's kind of an interesting read as to how that developed and what they're doing there and how things are looking. And good read. And then, of course, the last thing I have is our Clueless Pundit of the Week, which, as you say, might turn out to be Clueless Pundit of the Century. You want to talk about that now or later?
Let's dip into this now. Let's try to stay within the scope of this particular article before we get into segment two and some other aspects of this. But go ahead.
Yeah, Rob Enderle, our nearly perpetual Clueless Pundit of the Week, has written another screed and published in eWeek, of course, underneath the Enderle group tag, entitled "SCO Should Win." This dovetails with Stephen Vaughn's article describing why SCO can't win. Stephen Vaughn Nichols. And Stephen Vaughn Nichols, of course, has been a very, very fair columnist in eWeek for some time, and has been treating Linux very fairly. On the other hand, Rob Enderle, of course, gets our Clueless Pundit of the Week regularly. This is the biggest bunch of crap I've ever read in my life. I mean,
well,
how do you really feel,
Arnie?
This is, there I go, mincing words again. the arguments he makes about why SCO should win are just rattled my brain completely. I think my brain came loose a couple times when I was reading it. This is the biggest junk I've ever read. His argument about the legal argument is really funny. He's making the Dell dude argument. Basically, IBM apparently has changed a TV ad featuring a dropped ThinkPad. And originally the ad said, "Hey dude, where's my laptop?" And of course, IBM legal steps in and says, "Wait a minute, let's not do that." Enderle is arguing that this argues that if IBM knew that SCO owned the rights, even those rights were unclear, IBM policy would have required that IBM company seek SCO's approval before releasing any related code to the third party, such as the Linux community. I mean, this is a real stretch. I just don't get the connection here. This is where my brain skipped a cog or two. I mean, I just could not wrap my brain around what he was trying to argue here. It's silly.
Yeah, it sounds like he's saying that the cautious nature of IBM would have mandated them to act as if SCO were had a legitimate right to these things, and yet. You know, I mean, there we've had some other things like the unearthed statement from AT&T that Novell came up with, saying that derivatives clearly aren't covered by the copyright, et cetera. You know, things that are added that aren't directly related to the system 5 and all this sort of stuff. Things that I think everyone pretty much thought they understood about the way Unix was. Somehow he's arguing that IBM would have seen this coming, basically.
Except for one case, where SCO's claims were complete total doo-doo. And in that case, then all his arguments fall apart. You know, and there's another part of this. And this is, in order to justify this, this,
Because clams can't be complete horse pucky, otherwise I wouldn't be able to write a column this week. That's wonderful reasoning.
There you go. There you go.
Yeah, that's true. There's another side of this, part of this, and this is, there's an editor's note at the top of this to justify the article somehow. And editor's note, there are two sides to every story, including the battle over Linux, blah, 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 blah. Well, guess what, guys? Not everything is a duopoly. There are not two sides to every story. you report the facts and this is just a rubbish piece. This is a useless rubbish piece.
Well, you know, the interesting thing, it's interesting you mentioned that note, because some of the work that I've done with more mainstream publications, I have noticed particularly that in the assignment itself, they want to get a dissenting opinion. Whatever the pro is, they want to get a con, because they want to be dare I use the phrase, fair and balanced. And you know, it's interesting to see this sort of thing, trying to do the fair and balanced routine over SCO. And in one plane of my being, I understand the concept, but in another plane of being, you know, when you look at the facts, it gets really, really hard to come up with anything that actually works. And I think this particular column kind of shows how hard it is, because you know, you read it through and you're left scratching your head, like, you know, how did you come up with this?
I have a radical proposal waiting for the group.
Go ahead.
I think journalists ought to abandon the idea of being fair and balanced, and here's why.
Well, in this respect, yes.
Well, more generally, because when they try, what they end up doing is replacing conscious biases that are easy to spot with unconscious biases that are harder to spot and easier to be fooled by.
There's somewhat truth in
you
that.
You see this particularly in political news. There is a consensus journalistic culture view of the world, which leaks through in the way they arrange stories, the way they the quotes they select from people, the issues they choose to consider important and give headline space, the things they bury in the back page. And this constitutes it's a huge source of bias in the news, which a lot of people don't notice because they're not reading that analytically, where they would notice more conscious bias. If journalists didn't pretend to be fair and balanced, they would notice the kind of conscious huckstering that would be going on.
Put it this way, Ed Murrow would never worry about being fair and balanced. He would either do a straight reporting, or he would state his opinion clearly, and clearly state, this was my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard a piece the other day, retroflection on We See It Now, and that's the way he came off.
Mm-hmm.
The columnist of today is so afraid of stating an opinion that or formulating any kind of conclusion that I agree. It's kind of watered down news.
Yeah. Well, you know, I kind of wonder too if this feeds back into the loop that you mentioned earlier, Eric. That you know, the old media is becoming less and less an issue. And I wonder whether this this desire to approximate being fair and balanced is adding to that. That they've sort of buried the facts amidst counterbalancing opinions.
Well, I mean, that would be bad enough, but what's going on is worse. What's going on is systematic distorting and biasing of the news according to journalists' unconscious biases.
There you go.
And I think this has been going on all along. The reason these guys are losing market share and mind share is now people have alternative sources of information through the Internet, and they're able to fact-check what the journalists are telling them. This is one of the major functions that the blogosphere serves.
That's exactly true, because the links propagate through through the blogosphere, and it's really it becomes very easy with Google. One Google search gets you all the links you could ever want to check facts, and within seconds, like this is a good example, is exactly the reaction to some of the SEO stories the last year, where SCO would make a claim, and virtually within seconds on the net, it would be posted the evidence for the counterclaim.
And there are certain features of the journo culture worldview that are becoming impossible to sustain this in this environment. And I'm not going to talk about any of those because that would get into politics.
Okay. Well done.
But we all know this problem is out there.
It's coming to a head.
Yeah,
it certainly is.
And this piece is just an example of it going completely and utterly askew.
Well, let me run with this for just a second. I don't know if you have more after this, Arnie, but let me just branch off for one of the pieces I had here, and that is the letter to the editor about no IBM Grok Law connection by Pamela Jones over writing at ZDNet, and the link, of course, is on our webpage. But it kind of got me when I read the Enderly article earlier. He even makes, you know, allusions to the fact that IBM was funding Grok Law. And here we have a letter to the editor from...
The alleged fact. It's not a fact at all.
Well, I mean, I forget how he phrased it, but it sure came across like fact. Let's put it that way. But here you have, you know, Pamela Jones basically saying, listen, I've never gotten a thing from IBM, not so much as a laptop. Let alone any funding or servers or anything else. And this is great. I'm actually thrilled that that ZDNet at least published this, getting it to some degree into mainstream. But you know, this is the sort of thing, talking about cross-checking facts, that comes out and comes out very quickly on the web, where a claim like this can get shot down in a hurry.
Yeah. And a good example of where they're falling down, where are the journalists who should have been publishing the Halloween memoranda?
Yeah, you know, that was another thought, and let's, you know, let's go into
that. His name is Eric Raymond.
Let's go into that... you know, in segment
Why
two.
Why did I have to do this job?
But that is a real question. And during segment two, I'd like us to address that along with a couple other things having to do with what's going on right now.
Sorry, I didn't mean to anticipate.
No. That's fine. That'll keep our listeners tuned. Arnie, did you have anything else?
No, that's the last story I had.
Okay. I have a quickie here before we go to the break. And come back with Eric and get into some of this stuff. But there is an article at the Seattle Times called Upgrades Make Linux So Easy to Use. It's a very interesting piece as far as I'm concerned, because here is someone who I think is trying at least to be open-minded and whatnot, and frankly, he goes through Linux and he compares it to the types of Linux that he used a year or so ago, and he comes away very impressed. You know, the problems that he mentions have to do with things like, you know, the digital camcorder and some stuff like that. So you know, it's stuff that I think is well on target overall, and very mainstream, and it's kind of interesting to see it in a Seattle publication, just as an FYI. But I think it's a very interesting little piece.
This is part of this is another one of those desktop Linux articles that have been coming out recently, which have been quite favorable. There was, I think, is this the same one as the one that the guy installed Linux for the first time, or installed a desktop Linux system, Lindows, And is this the one that compares Lindows and another desktop system?
I think he used, this one is Lindows and Zandros are
yeah,
the two.
Yeah,
that
that's the one.
Time around.
And the guy says that, yeah, okay, there's some things that does do all right perfectly, but he says, but you know what? It does a lot of things very well and easier than Windows. And if this search suits you, this is, might be a solution for you. You know, and it's a very, very pragmatic, good article. Very pragmatic point of view.
Yeah, and I think this is very important, too, because, you know, there have been a lot of people in this industry that have claimed for the longest time that, you know, Linux would never be able to deal with the desktop. And I can tell you from where I'm sitting that I have seen a number of businesses, and I mean big businesses, that are seriously looking at Linux desktop rollouts. And it's not necessarily for the entire corporation or anything, but there are sections where it makes sense. And that's the way it's going to start. But the thing that I find most interesting is, like in the last 6 months, there have been a number of people that seem to have realized that, you know, Linux does well on the home desktop these days, too. The number of things keeping it off of a home desktop are shrinking.
Well, but we got a long way to go in end-user user interfaces.
Yeah, and
you know, that's been a recent hobby horse of mine.
Right. And but the thing is, you know, even a lot of those ones, some of the better distributions, the ones that have been focusing more on the desktop itself, have managed to deal with. And yeah, there's always room for improvement, but God knows some of the things that people are using on their desktop now have a lot of room for improvement as well.
One thing that's breaking right now that'll help is it looks like the Fedora guys are at least going to experiment with zero configuration networking. Have you seen this technology?
No, not offhand.
Oh, this is very cool. Apple's been shipping it since 1998. It's part of Mac OS X. There's an open source implementation, which the inventor is urging the Fedora project to adopt. And I just got mail on the Fedora list from one of the Fedora guys. He's saying he's going to make an RPM and add it to the repository. This is cool stuff. You bring up a little responder daemon, and it does some clever tricks with DNS and intercepting ARP packets. And the effect is, you plug two Ethernet-enabled devices together, and they just work. You plug in an Ethernet-enabled printer, and it shows up in your DNS space as something .local.
That's great.
Yeah, in effect, there's a new piece of your DNS called .local where Ethernet hot plugging takes place.
That's a great adaptive. That's a great adaptation of an existing technology, namely DNS.
It's fiendishly clever because the way it works is basically all tiny bits of patches and conventions using the existing TCP/IP infrastructure. The guy who wrote it, Cheshire, was very clever. He didn't try to reinvent the universe. For example, the basic technique for grabbing for auto-configuring IP addresses is you grab one and then you issue an ARP to see if that's in use. And if you don't get a response within a particular time period, then you know that nobody else on the local network has grabbed it.
That's great.
So you just keep trying addresses till you find one where you don't get an ARP conflict. And then there's similar tricks you can do with broadcast DNS, and there's one line of code in the DNS server to intercept requests to .local and send them somewhere else. And it's minimalist and it's elegant, and it's going to have the effect that most, for home users, most network administration is just going to go away.
That's excellent.
You know, and there's several standard stock home network topologies that this would work with.
Yeah.
And there's only a few of those that are you know, simple.
And yes, it does have the property that if you plug a zero-conf machine into a network, into the global internet, it doesn't do lots of broadcasting and thrashing and screwing things up.
We had an interesting thing happen at at the school a few weeks ago. Some one of the teachers brought in one of these wireless router hubs and plugged it into his machine into it. Unfortunately, I think what he did was he plugged, instead of plugging the upward LAN system, school system LAN into the WAN plug, he plugged it into the LAN plug.
Oh.
And so all of a sudden, this router is saying, I'm God over the greater network. And needless to say, there was a power failure that day. Just, well, you know, this is how they found out about it. There was a power failure. Everything came down quickly. And what happened is this little router, of course, being fast boot device, you know, everything in flash, came up quickly. And as all the rest of the machines on the greater network came up, they came up for DH, you know, to get their IP addresses. And of course, here's this little router madly giving out IP addresses. And of course, nothing is working. Yes, and no one knows about that. This little device is on the network, and all of a sudden, the network is gone, and they can't figure out why.
That's insanely funny.
It's a very, very, very good story.
Talk about a Napoleon complex.
Yeah.
Wow.
Here's this little, I think it was one of those little Linksys.
I wondered if the word Linksys was going to come up here. I really wondered.
Well, I mean, they're inexpensive. I've got one. They're great.
I love them. Hey, you know, I maintain the Linksys how-to.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I love those little boxes, but you got to be on your guard a bit because they cut corners.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I've got one, and it's sitting here doing all my routing. It's kind of nice.
All right. Well, let's go to break now. We went kind of long on segment one. We will be back in just a few minutes with Eric Raymond and talking more about...
You're not sick of me already.
Talking more about SCO. I think people are more sick about SCO than they are about you, Eric, believe me.
I'm not. That may constitute damning with faint praise.
Well, we'll deal with that, too. But, Kevin, let's go to break.
Thank you.
This is the Linux Show for March 9th, 2004. This is segment two. And for people who have been waiting for this, we have Eric Raymond. Eric, who, of course, is no stranger to this program. And we're going to talk a bit about, ta-da, SCO. But particularly about the document which has become to, has become known as Halloween 10. Eric, before we get into the details of this, you know, the Linux community certainly has an ever-growing number of people, and they probably there's probably some people out there who don't understand what a Halloween document is. Can you give us a little background in that, just to catch people up?
Sure. A brief recap of the Halloween saga. It begins on Halloween 1998, when I was leaked from inside Microsoft a document called Open Source Software, New Development Methodology. It was dynamite. At the time, Microsoft had been in a very consistent posture of denial about Linux. They'd been saying, oh, our customers aren't talking about it, we don't care, it's trivial, it's nothing, it's hobbyists in people's garages, it doesn't matter, we don't care. This memo was an internal study done by an engineer with the imprimatur of several very senior figures at Microsoft on the actual challenge that Linux posed to them, and it was dynamite. This memo said, okay, there are things, this is a very serious problem, short-term, medium, and long-term. There are things we must do, and it talked about stuff like decommoditizing protocols. It basically came out and said, we must lock down the customer before they escape. And this was big news. I published it on the, I called it the Halloween document, later Halloween 1, because I had received it at on Halloween. And it became something of a 9 days wonder. It got a lot of coverage, not just in the tech, but in the mainstream press. And then less than 2 days later, what should happen but that I receive a second Halloween document, which was the follow-up to the original one that had been produced by a team, including the author of Halloween 1. And it wasn't quite the blockbuster that Halloween 1 was, but there were some pretty juicy phrases in it. Let me hit a highlight or two from, let's see, Halloween 1. I'm looking through my list of wonderful bullet quotes from it. Let's see. Open source software is long-term credible. FUD tactics cannot be used to combat it. Well, that's a recommendation they didn't follow. Recent case studies, the Internet, provide very dramatic evidence that commercial quality can be achieved or exceeded by open source projects. Remember, this is Microsoft talking. Here's a nice one. Linux can win as long as services and protocols are commodities. And the last quote, the one I really like, the ability of the open source process to collect and harness the collective IQ of thousands of individuals across the Internet is simply amazing. More importantly, open source evangelization scales with the size of the Internet much faster than our own evangelization efforts appear to scale. That is, they're collecting more brains and they're winning. So this was huge. Within 3 days, I had received, I think, three different copies of these documents from two different sources, none of which I have ever named. As a journalist, I protect my sources. And I think this helped produce a significant crack in Microsoft's Citadel, because it's very hard to argue that that Microsoft saying, oh, there's nothing here, just ahead, there's nothing to see here. It's very hard to argue that that's correct when you can quote Microsoft's own internal memoranda back at them.
Right.
So, scant days later, there followed Halloween 3, which was a PR statement by a Microsoft spin doctor in the Netherlands, which was, I just had a lot of fun taking it apart. I recommend the reader go look at it. All through this statement, there are these Microsoft worldview assumptions that sort of stick out at you and hit you in the head. And perhaps the one that's most significant, given the Halloween 10 story, is I'm going to quote her last statement. She says, let's see if I can find this thing here. She says, unless Linux violates IP rights, it will fail to deliver innovation over the long run. And there's an implication delivered elsewhere in the memo that lawsuits could be coming, and perhaps coming from Microsoft.
Interesting. So let's hit the warp speed and
okay. Sorry, and, I'll fast forward here.
So how does this relate to what's known as Halloween 10? How does this all play in?
Okay. Well, skipping rapidly over Halloween 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. Halloween 10 happened when somebody inside the present SCO sent me an internal memorandum that was written from a guy named Mike Anderer to Chris Sontag, who basically more or less runs the place. And this memo went into juicy detail. It was actually a Dunning letter. It was this guy Anderer saying, look, I brought in the deal, now give me my commission. And the deal he was talking about bringing in involved landing as much as $86 million in corporate development from Microsoft. And one of the juicy lines was Microsoft, that he says Microsoft would prefer to funnel this money through organizations such as Baystar. And it said, the memo basically said, Baystar cooperated with Microsoft on this. And this is flatly contrary to SCO's and Microsoft's repeated denials then and now that Microsoft had anything to do with the funding.
Right.
Now, to understand the magnitude of these numbers, you have to get that the minimum amount, the memo is really ambiguous, it's badly written. The guy is semi-literate and, judging by his writing, pretty stupid. I don't know how guys like this pull down multi-million-dollar commissions. But he's only semi-literate, so the language isn't really clear. But the figures in the memo imply a low end of $66 million of Microsoft payoff and a high end of $106. Now, even if you take the low end of $66, it turns out that is one-third of SCO's entire market cap. Furthermore, compared to this amount of money, even their inflated market cap, even at their present crazy stock price, and then you look at their 10-Qs and you discover that relative to the amount of money they've been taking in per quarter from IBM, every other source of income they have is statistical noise. It's nothing.
Wow.
So that's the contact. That's the context. And as I put it in my summary after the memo, at least a third of SCO's market capitalization and their entire current cash reserves, the low-end figure in that range, $66 million, is nearly identical to the $68.5 million that they declared as a cash position in their first quarter 10-Q. So effectively, all the money that SCO now has in the bank is money that Microsoft gave them.
Oh, Eric. Chris Sontag isn't going to be sending you any Christmas cards in a long time.
Hey, I'm just reading the memo.
Now, obviously, you knew when you put this out there that there would be reactions coming from both Microsoft and SCO.
Yeah, they buy through their teeth. Yes, I was expecting that.
Now, can you summarize what their reactions were for people who might not have read?
Okay, the lie from Microsoft is we had nothing to do with the Baystar deal. The lie from SCO is Microsoft had nothing to do with the Baystar deal, and the memo is that they admitted the memo is authentic, but they said the consultant that was writing the memo didn't actually understand the deal that he was describing. This is the deal he negotiated for SCO, brought to a successful resolution, and was expecting to be paid a commission on. This is the deal they say he didn't understand.
Well, that's quite difficult to do, I would say.
Yeah. You know, I've been watching the Looney Tunes Golden Collection recently. And I have to tell you that certain of the SCO guys and certain of the Warner Brothers characters are blurring together in my head. In fact, Looney Tunes characters from 1940 Blip, in general, behave more rationally than these SCO people.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, the interesting thing, one of the things that gets me about all of this, is I read some of the published reactions from Microsoft and SCO, and at least inside the articles that I read on the subject, there seemed to be statements thrown in about how Eric misunderstood or was reading things into the document, which I find absolutely astounding, because if you haven't read the actual memo, you know, please go over to the website there and read it. Because
it's fairly straightforward. It's not that long either.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Here's a quote. Microsoft also indicated there was a lot more money out there, and they would clearly rather use Baystar-like entities to help us get more significantly more money.
Yeah. You know, I mean, there are things here where you could maybe quibble over some of the details of the numbers, but it's absolutely impossible to read this document and not walk away with the notion that Microsoft reportedly funneled millions and millions of dollars into SCO through these dealings.
Yeah, here's a quote. Microsoft, this is a direct quote, I'm not editing anything. He says at one point, I realized in the last negotiations are not as much fun, but Microsoft will have brought in $86 million for us, including Baystar. The next deal we should be able to get from 16 to 20, but it will be brutal as it's for go-to-market work and some licenses. The key phrase here is Microsoft will have brought in $86 million for us, including Baystar.
Yeah. That's, you know, there isn't much you can do with that statement.
Now, there's one interpretation of the numbers that says the last deal didn't go through. The 16 to 20 deal he was talking about didn't happen. And if you take the high end of that deal, then he's saying that at the time he wrote, they had already brought in $66 million. But there is another interpretation that says the $86 million is the deal that has already gone down. And if they got that next deal he was talking about, then Microsoft's subsidy of SCO amounted to over $100 million.
Even the writer of the memo, he even says that it's a lot of money.
Yeah, it's that stuff is pretty wild, and you really can't talk about interpretations too much, because like you said, even if you get all the interpretations wrong, you're still stuck with, you know, $60+ million floating around. It's absolutely astounding. And the thing that you know, I find very curious is that instead of trying to distance themselves, I mean, SCO did to a certain degree try to distance themselves from the memo. Instead, you kind of get this sense being thrown out that, well, you know, this is just Eric doing his thing again. For people who haven't seen it, over on NewsForge, there is an analysis that went up, yesterday, called Analysis Microsoft SCO Have a Lot More Explaining to Do by Chris Primesberger. And we hope that in time we will have Chris on the show as well to talk about some of the things that they're looking into. But if this is an interesting piece, if you haven't read it, please go ahead and do so.
One of the high points is there is reason to believe that an FCC investigation of this matter has been launched.
Right.
It certainly would not be legal for them to do this kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I've heard unconfirmed reports, I won't talk about from where, I have unconfirmed reports that the FCC has already traced the Baystar money back to a brokerage in Redmond.
Ooh.
Now, here's another little tidbit that I just picked up today. Baystar Capital is owned by another outfit, another investment outfit called Vulcan Capital. Vulcan Capital has a majority owner. who, through Vulcan, controls Baystar. His name is Paul Allen.
Indeed.
Yes. Bill Gates is co-founder at Microsoft.
Indeed. How quite interesting. So, you know, obviously there's going to be a lot more coming on this issue. You know, this may be truly the smoking gun that people have been waiting for.
And
go ahead. But the other side of this that we mentioned when we were talking a little bit during the break, a question still remains, and that is that if you're a reader of, you know, NewsForge and Linux Today, and you listen to this program and so forth, you've heard about this. But why and where is the coverage about this inside the greater news media? I mean, you can't turn on the TV without hearing how Martha Stewart apparently has been, you know, convicted for making you know, whatever it was, $40,000 or $50,000 on insider trading that she was never charged with. But here we're talking about, you know, one company that has been subject to, you know, almost unprecedented you know, federal action in
a
the past.
A convicted predatory monopolist slips a lawsuit-happy failing company $100 million under the table to attack its biggest competitor, and that isn't news?
Exactly. Why is it that that people are having to get this from us? And there have been a few news outlets that have touched on it, but God knows, not that much.
Well, we've gotten a couple of good mentions. One was from Hiawatha Bray at the Boston Globe. He ran with the story. And also, Business Week is going to do a big story on this.
Oh, that should be interesting. But, yeah, you know, it stymies me that, you know, people are more worried about Martha Stewart and what that does to her company. And we have something here that is, you know, kind of the pivot, dealing with the pivot pin of technology, for crying out loud.
And to the magnitude of this here, it is literally the case that governments have fallen over less money than is involved here.
Yeah. It's astounding. It's absolutely astounding. But the lack of hardcore coverage is almost, well, is possibly more astounding than the story itself. And it kind of begs the question, why? What is it?
Esco stock is currently at $10.25 per share. It's dropped 9%+ today, which is like about a point or so.
Well, you know,
and in the last few weeks, it's just slipping away.
Yeah, I think, as I recall, just after Thanksgiving, it was up around 19, getting ready to kiss 20. And
it did kiss 20, I think, once or twice.
But it's, you know, lost at least 40% of its value here in the land.
One piece of interesting news is a lot of people would like to short this stock. You can't. Shorts have been saturated, is my understanding.
Gee, I wonder why.
I wonder how the put options are going.
That is, you know, it's beyond belief. But this is a story. This may be finally, you know, and as I mentioned earlier, there are a lot of people, myself included, frankly, who are really tired of this whole SCO situation. But we may be seeing finally the wheels coming off the wagon.
Well, and there could be consequences beyond that. I will make no bones about what my objective is in this situation. This is one I've had consistently in mind since the lawsuit started. I don't want SCO to just lose. I want them to lose ugly. I want them to be a frightening example for every other commercial predator in the future who thinks that we're an easy target. I want CEOs and CEIOs and CTOs or anybody suggests running a patent attack or a copyright infringement lawsuit or any of that kind of stuff against an open source project. And this is the beginning of what could make that happen, because there is every possibility of criminal charges here, of people going to jail. And I'm not just talking about SCO either, because if it can be proven that Microsoft had its fingers in this pie, the stuff that's involved here is felonious.
Yeah.
Let me go after just one angle on this. This is something my friend Rob Landley pointed out. From one angle, this has all the ingredients of a classic stock scam. And the two cooperating parties are, on the one hand, Microsoft, and on the other hand, the Canopy Group, who, after the Monterey Project, found itself holding a whole bunch of stock in SCO that was essentially worthless. So Microsoft wanted a FUD machine. Canopy wanted to be able to sell that stock at a price that wasn't a horrible loss for them. So whether it's an explicit agreement or a tacit agreement, I don't know, but the agreement they seem to have ended up with is Microsoft will pump lots of war chest money into SCO. SCO will do what Microsoft wants, and having all that money pumped into SCO and the resultant publicity will spike SCO's stock price to the point where the Canopy Group holders can sell it off at way above what its natural value is.
And a bunch of them did.
And a bunch of them did. And who loses in this? Any honest investor who was duped into going long on SCO. This is a stock scam. This is called securities fraud. This is called stock kiting. The SEC puts people in jail for this kind of thing.
Well, this is one of the things, too, that right now it's a theory, but it'll be interesting to see how it ends up down the road a little bit.
The conjecture sure is interesting, though. This is a very damning document.
This is probably the hottest of the Halloween memos since one, I think.
Right. Yeah, I think I would agree with you there. This is
have anybody acknowledged this document to be legitimate?
Yes. SCO has conceded that this memo is authentic. Yes, and they've tried to deny that it means what it means.
Why would they accept it as being? Because it could be subpoenaed. That's why.
Okay, let me ask you, Eric, for the record, are you now, or in the recent past, an employee of IBM Corporation, or compensated by saying?
I am not an employee of IBM Corporation.
Okay.
And my present indebtedness to IBM constitutes one laptop that Dan Fry gave me a couple years back, because he liked what I was doing.
Okay, that's disclosure. And for folks, too, if you want to go out to the website, we have a link over to SCO So Despised That Chief Is Armed. It talks about how Darryl McBride says that since he is getting death threats, he occasionally is packing a weapon to protect himself. And as I recall here, I'm trying to find it in the article, it's not jumping out at me, he makes allusions to the fact that in their investigation they found that some of these people who were threatening him were felons, etc. And of course the implication is that somehow these felons are inside the open source community. Eric, let me ask you the question, are you an armed felon trying to kill Darryl McBride?
Half of that claim is correct. I am armed. I am not a felon trying to kill Darryl McBride. There was a funny, thread on Slashdot where people were speculating on, quote, ESR, unquote, versus Darryl at 20 paces. and I resisted the temptation to jump in and comment that I wouldn't fight a pistol duel with him because I don't want him to die. I want him to live and suffer and be a horrible example.
Yeah.
No, you don't want him to die. No one wants that.
Not only that, you have more experience with guns, Eric.
I don't know that that's true, actually.
Welcome back to the show, Jeff.
The guy could be a better shot than me. It's not likely, but it's possible.
Well, Jeff, do you have any final notes? Because actually, we're just about ready to wrap up.
Oh, no, I just wanted to stop and say hi. Sorry for missing the show, but just glad you guys carried on and pulled it all off. I do want to chime in with one thing. I've gotten a lot of information emailed to me over the course of the last 4 or 5 hours since I posted the original press release to Linux PR about a call to action getting people to go to the SEC and file a formal complaint. I've got about 10 different emails in my box where people are giving me supplemental information. So I'm going to be drafting up an HTML document and posting it to our website later on tonight, probably around midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning, that'll give us people a little bit more detail on how to fill out an SEC claim, because it's a little scary when you first see the forms. They're asking for security numbers and stock information, and you really don't need to put that kind of information in a claim. All you need to do when you're filing a complaint is say, hey, I would have bought this stock if he hadn't said this. You don't need to be much more specific than that when filing a claim. But I'll have that information up, like I said, midnight, 1 o'clock tonight. Just keep an eye on our website sometime over the course of the week. And also, I do want to apologize to all those people who have been sending me email going, where's the Daily Show? Well, I got busy late last week and didn't get all the technology issues resolved as I thought I would. We are wrapping them up. Hopefully I'll have a chance to get together with Kevin over the course of the next day or two. We should have everything resolved by Friday of this week. And so keep an eye out again for press releases on Linux Today announcing the beginning of the Linux Daily Show. Just a couple days away. We should have it all done. But that's it for me tonight, Russ. You can go ahead and finish up.
Okay. Eric, do you have any closing thoughts for us?
Just that, well, I've been dealing with a lot of journalists lately. There's definitely a lot of interest in this story out there, and I don't think we've seen anywhere near all the press stories that are going to get written about it.
There's nothing in news.com. There's nothing on the Register about this, in their headlines at least.
Hmm. Well, I think the Register actually touched on it earlier, but let's see. It seems like there's so much smoke now that there's got to be fire here. I mean, it just doesn't seem to play out any other way. Anyway, we've gone well past our normal tempted closing time of the hour, so let's wrap it up for this week. This is the Linux Show for March 9th, 2004. We thank everyone for listening this week, and we'll have some more great stuff next week. So tell 10 friends. And for everyone here at the Linux Show, good night and thank you.